take both parts and stick them in the ground deep. He just wants to flip the connections of his antenna output, I think.
He might be able to do that, but there might not be an advantage in doing it. Let me start off with a basic dipole, the most basic antenna, in free space. At one instant of time, the right-hand side of the dipole is positive, the left-hand side is negative. If you put a sheet of metal right in the middle of the dipole at right angles to the wire, that sheet of metal is halfway between the positive end and the negative end. It's in the neutral plane. Putting the sheet of metal there does nothing. It doesn't change the impedance, the pattern, the standing wave ratio. Nothing changes because you put that sheet of metal there. Once you've got that very large sheet of metal, an infinite sheet of metal, in the middle of your dipole at right angles to the wire, you suddenly realize you don't have to use the two halves of the dipole. You can use the first half of the dipole with reference to the sheet of wire, the sheet of metal, and then throw away the other half of the dipole. You've just constructed a ground plane antenna. And as long as the sheet of metal goes to infinity, the ground plane antenna works like a charm. Now you can start making the sheet of metal smaller and making it as a bunch of quarter wavelength long radials. But the counterpoise of a normal antenna is that one side of it acts like the Earth, an infinite sheet of metal, in the case of a trickle ground plane antenna, and the other part is the resonating radiator. Let me drop it. The majority of the good radiating characteristics of that ground plane antenna is the fact that the rod in the center is electronically a quarter wavelength long, or half wavelength long, depending on your design, and it resonates. The signal bounces back and forth in there a whole lot of times before it finally gets radiated, and all those bounces are in step with each other. That's the definition of resonance. When you stick the radiator section into the ground, it's no longer resonant. It's now in this very lossy material. And so it makes a lossy kind of counterpoise, and then the counterpoise rod sticking up in the air can do the radiating, but it's going to be a less efficient antenna. And I think there's no advantage of reversing the elements, so to speak, the way you use the elements. There's no advantage in doing that. Could you come up with a brand new antenna design because you've made the ground plane antenna upside down? And would it be a desirable antenna? I think the answer is it's not a desirable antenna. I think it's not going to work well. On top of that, your transmission line, let me drop it. Your transmission line, which often is a piece of coax cable, you'd like the shield of the coax cable connected to the counterpoise. Hopefully it's the part of the antenna that has no voltage on it. Therefore, you're not launching voltage onto the outside of the transmission line, the coax cable. With your inverted ground plane antenna, you would, unless you're very careful, you're going to have a very hot transmission line, which in some cases is undesirable. So you could force it to work. Is it an advantage? I doubt it. I guess that rod going into the ground could be a very long, very flat rod, and therefore it acts like a counterpoise. And so now it's a matter of semantics as to whether or not you've really inverted the antenna. If you make the rod big enough and long enough so it acts as a good counterpoise, you've just changed the design of the counterpoise, and you slightly changed the design of the radiator section, but it's still a fairly similar antenna, but a slightly lower performance. You see where I'm going on this one now, Roy. It's an interesting thought experiment, but I don't think there's much advantage to be gained. AC2GS, K2IW in the TechNet.
Comet, KD2FIU.
Yeah, stand by, George. Let's hear Roy first.
AC2GS. I think the important line of his question is, can the signal be reversed? I don't think he's thinking in terms of changing the antenna at all. He's just changing the two circuits. The one feeding the antenna is going into his counterpoise. The one that used to be directed at his counterpoise is connected at his antenna. And I think what he's missing is the fact that, especially in a balanced antenna output, it's meaningless, which is which. There's no ground, there's no antenna, there's no plus, there's no minus. They're balanced and equivalent. I think that's the nature of his particular question, although the answer to the question that you interpreted as is great. I agree with that. I just don't think that that's the question.
Okay, if I take an ordinary half-wave dipole and I decide to sink half of it into the ground, whether I sink the left-hand half into the ground or the right-hand half into the ground, the two antennas are really identical. So there's another factor going on here when it comes to a balanced antenna, and you decide which end you're going to ground and which end you're not going to ground. You see where I'm going on that one now, Roy? AC2GGS, K2LIW.
Yeah, but wouldn't they be mirror equivalents of the same radiator?
If you're properly feeding in a balanced manner your dipole, and on the first experiment you bury the left-hand side, and the second experiment you bury the right-hand side, and now you measure the performance of those two antennas, there will be no difference. It's a symmetric antenna, and it doesn't matter which side you decide to ground. Is that close to what you're asking, Roy? Go ahead.
That's what I think his question is really fundamentally asking. Is the signal inherently polarized, you know, like a battery, like a DC power supply, plus and minus? Is there a correct way to connect an antenna output or an incorrect one? And if you plug it in the wrong way, does everything go in the opposite direction? Which it really doesn't. I mean, for an unbalanced antenna output, there are complications. But in the purest sense, if it's a balanced antenna output, there's absolutely no difference. It's a symmetrical condition. He doesn't mention anything about burying anything in the ground, just using the wrong output for the antenna and the wrong output for the counterpoint.
Okay, go ahead, George.
Remember, the electromagnetic wave, of course, you guys know this, and you've told me this, it depends on the conductors. Now, you take certain antennas, can be built very effectively. There are capacitive end-fed vertical dipoles off-center dimensions. The bottom could be larger, the top could be larger, capacitive end-fed. So it doesn't matter which pole is of your radio that's coming out on your radio. The electromagnetic magnetic wave is going to resonate depending upon the metallic conductor that you construct. So it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. As far as using antennas on the ground, use a lot of power. Resonate the earth, and you'll get right out there into space. But what I'm saying is, as far as the antenna is concerned, it doesn't have to be the center lead. It has to be a very good metallic construction in order for all of it to resonate properly, or each pole of energy to resonate properly with all of its inductance and capacitance.
I think I pretty much agree with what you're saying, George. You kept using the word metallic. I'm going to substitute the word conductive. As long as the material is built into the radiator section of your antenna, it's highly conductive. In some cases, that could be a highly conductive fluid. It doesn't have to be a metallic. So major portions of your efficient antenna are going to be a highly conductive material. That's a requirement number one. Requirement number two, the usual antennas we use resonate. That means the signal you apply to the antenna is going to bounce back and forth a large number of times, and all those bounces stay in phase with each other. That's one of the definitions of resonance. And the reason you want resonance is because that gives you a current buildup. The current buildup gives you a magnetic field buildup, and arguably the magnetic field is the major portion of the beginning of the radiation process. Not everyone's going to agree with that. So conductive, resonant, and now how you feed it. In the case of putting energy into a flywheel, I can put the push rod going to the flywheel near the pivot point or near the perimeter. Near the perimeter, it's going to be a high impedance point on the flywheel. Near the pivot point, near the center, it's going to be a very low impedance point. But as long as I've got the right kind of impedance matcher, it doesn't matter. So you can feed the radiator section of your antenna, if you're smart enough, at the low end, the middle, the top end, and so on. So how you feed energy into the antenna, it's just a matter of proper impedance matching, that method of feeding it. The radiator itself, as long as it's resonant, it does its thing. As long as it's highly conductive material, it doesn't lose energy by way of I squared R loss if it's a partially conductive material. Let me drop this. So all normal antennas have those three criteria: highly conductive, resonant, and impedance matched by some means in your method of feeding energy into it. You obey those three rules, you're going to have an efficient radio antenna. The signal itself coming out of the antenna is an AC signal. You could say it spends half of its time positive and half of its time negative, no matter which portion of the antenna you're talking about. So it is a dual polarized signal that's radiated in space. It has no favored polarization in voltage. It has a favored polarization in polarimetry. In other words, is it a horizontally polarized signal, a vertically polarized signal, a clockwise polarized signal, an elliptically polarized signal? So it's got a polarization characteristic, which is a matter of the way you've physically adjusted the conductor of the antenna and where it resonates. So once you meet those three criteria, conductive, resonant, and impedance matched, you're going to get an efficient antenna by the usual radio definition. And let me show you if there's an alternate definition here. Let me drop. If I was operating the electromagnetic compatibility department, electromagnetic interference department of a company, and I'm making a measurement of the shielding characteristics of the box around your chunk of electronics, and if the specification is that all extraneous radiation from the box are supposed to be suppressed by 60 decibels, a well-shielded box will do that. If I got a box that's poorly shielded, and the signal coming out is not 60 dB suppressed, it's 55 dB suppressed, we'll say that that box is the spec is 65 dB, and my box is only meeting 60. So my box is 60 dB down when the spec is 65 of shielding characteristic. I will call that box a radiator. It's 60 dB down. It means the energy coming out of the box is 1 million times weaker than the signal that's going into the box. That's what 60 dB means, a million to one ratio. That guy will call that a radiator. Well, that's 0.0001% efficiency radiation. You and I would not be satisfied with that. So by our normal definition of radiation, we want 90-some-odd% of the energy we put into the antenna to be radiated into space. So you've got to be careful about the word radiation. The EMI and EMC people, they got their alternate definition. Anybody with any further questions or comments on all of the above, give me a call that is right now, KQRIW in the TechNet.
WS1.
Go ahead, Paul. Wait for the beeps.
When I heard Roy read the question, I was thinking that the guy was thinking that he had maybe a half wave vertical, you know, and he's got a ground set up on it. He's got two wires coming from his radio, and unlike what I have, is regular coax coming out of an SO239 in the back. Maybe he's got a radio, an old fashioned one with two screws, and he's coming out with ladder line, and he's running the ladder line to the halfway vertical, and maybe he's thinking at the radio or at the antenna. Does it matter which way I put the wire, one way or the other? You know, that's the way I read the question when I heard it from Roy. Back to you, sir.
Yeah, one way of interpreting what you just said, Paul, is that if I got open wire transmission line going to an antenna, and right at the antenna I disconnect the two sides of the open wire line and reverse them left to right, do I have the same antenna? And if you're feeding the antenna correctly, the answer is nothing has changed. Yes, you've made a 180-degree phase shift of the signal radiated by the antenna. And if out in space I was making careful phase measurements. I've got a sample signal coming from the transmitter going to that remote site, and I've got an antenna at the remote site, and I'm now listening to the phase difference of the signal reference versus what's radiant space, and I reverse the two leads of the open wire line at my transmitting antenna. With the right kind of instrumentation, I can sense the fact that a 180-degree phase shift of radiation took place. Under normal circumstances, without that reference cable going back to the transmitter, you can't make that measurement. You wouldn't know the difference. Oh, I guess it's possible by extremely accurate clocks and by way of at some zero time we start the transmission, so to speak, and we could measure phase that way. Very difficult. So most antennas have a degree of symmetry to them. Dipole-like antennas are very symmetrical. A ground plane antenna, I'll admit, looks non-symmetric. But as long as you meet those three criteria, it will, by ham radio standards, give you an efficient radiator. And there are more than 5,000 kinds of antennas. There's a zillion different ways you can bend that conductor and things that force resonance. Let me drop. You can force resonance of a piece of conductor that's not the right length by putting top hat capacitors on it, by putting loading coils on it, by making it helically wound, by zigzagging it, bending it left and right and up and down. So there's all kinds of ways you can take a non-resonant length of conductor and forcing it into resonance by adding objects to the conductor itself. And even if you don't add objects directly to the conductor, you can indirectly add objects to the conductor by putting a antenna tuner on the antenna. The antenna tuner can act like a loading coil, act like a top hat capacitor, and so on. The antenna tuner added to your conductor, that's the wrong length, can force it into resonance, and as long as the radiating structure is resonant, by ham radio standards, it will be an efficient radiator. Now, the radiating structure consists of the thing that you call antenna, the thing that you call transmission line, the thing that you call impedance matching network, and in some cases, the final tank coil of the transmitter, which has got a tuning and loading control to it. All of that is the radiating structure. If you make the total radiating structure resonant, you can achieve efficient radiation. AC2GS for any further comments on all of the above. K2RIW, go ahead, Roy.
KD2HUC, Washington.
And to extend with response to Dr. Roy.
This is AC2GS, and all you guys will have your turn. It's just a long time ago I was listening on a repeater, and some guy actually was starting to talk about the positive output of his antenna. And I think that's part of this misunderstanding of antenna outputs, that they don't have a positive and negative. I think they're confused by the fact that the shield has some relation to ground, that infer that there's a electric polarity of antenna connectors where there really aren't. I think that's what this question might be about.
Whoa, wait a minute. No.
Steve is the next person who wanted to make a comment. KD2HUC, go right ahead, Steve.
Hey, Dick, when I heard this, it to me it sounded almost like he was using a, you know, like a vertical, almost like an Antron type setup, where you have the vertical radiator and then you have the three radials tied to the collar. And if you're running an unbalanced system, to me it sounds like what he wanted to do was tie the center conductor to the ground radials and tie the shield to the center radiator. And that to me sounded like what he wanted to do, assuming that the antenna itself is not grounded in any other way. KD2HUC, back to net.
And Steve, if he made that connection, if the center conductor normally goes to the radiator and the shield normally goes to the counterpoise, and he reverses the two as long as he has the right kind of a balloning device on the end of that transmission line, which could be a poor man's ballon, a few turns of the coax cable coiled together, or a real floating primary, secondary transformer type ballon, as long as he has the right kind of a balloning device. If he reverses his semiconductor and shield at the antenna, nothing will happen. The real signal being radiated will be 180 degrees different, and with careful measurements, you could detect the fact that that change took place. But the real signal that the guy receives will sound the same. The radiation pattern will be the same. So there's nothing magic about the signal that's on the semiconductor versus the signal that's on the shield, other than the fact the signal on the shield is normally considered a grounded signal, but with the right kind of a balloning device, you can remove that ground requirement, so to speak. And so after the balloning device, the antenna will act as if you have fed it with open wire lines, so to speak, a thoroughly balanced transmission line. And therefore, the rest of the system will know no difference. You see where I'm going with that one, Steve? Is that sort of what you were saying? KD2HUC, K2LIW?
Yeah, so then it sounds to me like the answer is no. If he's using an unbalanced system, then no, it won't work, because you require a balun to convert it to a balanced system before you connect to the antenna. An unbalanced system, from what I'm hearing from you, you cannot reverse the leads and have it work effectively. That you require a balun and convert to a balanced system prior to connection to the antenna. And I think everybody agrees, once you're in a balanced situation, it doesn't really matter which end is which. KD2HEC, back to net.
Yeah, there's one further factor here, though, Steve. If now you dumbly connect semiconductor of the coax to the counterpoise and shield of the coax to the radiator, will that work? The answer is yes. It may not work well. The thing that you call radiator now consists of the real quarter wavelength electronically rod that's called radiator, and connected to that is the shield of the coax cable, which is now part of the radiator. So you're now radiating simultaneously from the real radiator and from the coax cable. Will people hear you? Yes. Will it be efficient? Now that's a problem. Depending on the layout of that coax cable, which is now doing some of the radiation, you change the resonant frequency of your radiator because you've now lumped it together with the shield of the coax. And the shield of the coax is going to be doing a substantial amount of radiating. People will hear you. You might have RF in the shack. You may have some other disadvantages. But you can't say it's going to completely fail to work. It's not going to work very well in the average installation. It's not a desirable situation. But there are people who have made mistakes like that, and they did get out. People did hear them. If that's the way you connected the antenna at the top of the tower, and the transmission line is running down the side of the tower, believe it or not, that will work. I didn't say it's going to work well. It'll work, and people will hear you. Ain't that crazy? KQLIW listening.
Fair enough. So then he would have to account for his coax, the shield length, and whatnot in order to make it work. Okay. Fair enough. KD2HUC, back to net.
It has to be KD2FIU.
And you said he would have to account for. If he didn't know he hooked it up backwards, he wouldn't be accounting for it. And it would work. And very few of us go and measure the efficiency of our radiating system. Very few of us do that. Very few of us measure how much RF energy is crawling down the outside of the transmission line. Until we start getting a lot of RF in the shack and a lot of phony characteristics, a lot of television interference, radio interference, maybe your rig starts behaving in peculiar ways because the RF energy coming down the coax gets fed into the push buttons on the front panel, so to speak, and starts making the radio act crazy. And so you get funny RF effects in the shack, and maybe a spark jumping from the tip of your metallic microphone into your lip. Until you start getting some funny RF effects like that, you wouldn't know that you've made a mistake. So it could work. may not work well. It's not a desirable situation. It's something to try to avoid, but it's not the end of the world, if you know what I mean, as far as radiating is concerned. Let me drop it. If you are smart enough, any conducting object, in some cases a non-conducting object, but any conducting object can be made into a radiator. Doesn't have to necessarily be exactly the right length, the right shape, and so on. The majority of classical antennas are particular shapes and lengths. But with a very large range antenna tuning assembly, you can make anything radiate a radio signal. As I've often said, there are plain clothes automobiles where the side view mirror is the antenna, where the slot between the fender and the rest of the sheet metal of the car is the antenna, where the speaker near the back window of the vehicle is an antenna. You can make any conducting object into an antenna. Leading edge of an aircraft wing, the leading edge of the rudder of an aircraft can be made into an antenna if you're smart enough. So of the 5,000 kinds of antennas that I believe exist, some of them are pretty wild looking. Some of them are very non-obvious as an antenna. There are lots of ways of hiding an antenna inside or on the sheet metal or on the surface of a vehicle, and you might not recognize it as an antenna. If you're smart enough with the right kind of an antenna tuner and a beats matching device. Let me drop. Every one of the modern cell phones that we use have an antenna inside that for the frequencies you're using, it is much too small, it is much too undesirably laid out. The early cell phones used to have a whip antenna sticking out of the top of the end of the cell phone. In some cases, the whip antenna can be pulled out or not pulled out. And a lot of people didn't bother pulling out the antenna. And it didn't radiate as well, but it still radiated. So the antenna inside of every one of our cell phones being used on a whole lot of frequencies simultaneously. By simultaneously, I mean there are periods of time when you're on 1900 megs, 1800 megs, 2.2 gigs, 900 megs, and so on. At various times, your antenna inside that cell phone is operating on all of those crazy frequencies, and they can get away with that because the nearest integrated circuit chip to that antenna is an impedance matching device. There is an antenna tuner built into that cell phone. So that piece of metallic conductor in there called antenna, which is the wrong length with the wrong layout, is forced into being a pretty good radiator by way of that impedance matching device. Ain't that crazy? Not the best way to do it, but it works. And quite often you'll see a picture in some of the magazines showing the antenna pattern of the cell phone held against the head of a human being. And they show you the antenna pattern as if it all does its radiating out away from the human head. Let me drop. That diagram is phony. The thickness of the cell phone against your head has too little dimension in the Z direction, so to speak, the direction away from your head. There's too little dimension there for it to have any substantial amount of directivity. The amount of antenna pattern away from your head and the amount of antenna pattern toward your head is almost the same. The laws of physics does not give it the ability to select one over the other. There isn't enough material there in that dimension to give it that kind of directivity. That's the bad news. The good news is the total amount of energy coming out of that cell phone is small enough. And because RF energy, when it hits a human being, the only effect it has that can be confirmed is that of the energy that's absorbed by the human being, it's turned into heat. And as long as the heat that's being generated is below a certain threshold, it creates no deleterious effects. There is no proven... We call it RF radiation from that cell phone. It's a poor choice of words that alarm the hell out of us because we relate it to nuclear radiation. It should have been called radio transmission, radio signaling, because that's what it does. And so that cell phone, if you use it at the maximum range from your cell site, so it has to go to maximum power in order to communicate with the cell site. Let me drop. Which in some cases is 0.3 watt. And if that 0.3 watt, the signal that gets radiated into your head, creates a temperature increase of the nearby material of 0.1 degree Fahrenheit, and maybe those are real numbers, your body can easily handle that. And the nearest part of your head, the brain, has got a prodigious amount of blood flowing through it. It's a beautiful cooling system. It can tolerate an awful lot of that RF energy trying to heat your brain material. And it doesn't have enough resources to do very much of that. Lots of people have worried about whether or not cell phones are creating brain cancer. And they've been looking for years for that evidence. It essentially is not there. The physics there, there's not enough energy radiated to create enough temperature increase to create enough damage, with rare exception. There might be a very sensitive human being that's right on the threshold of getting a cancer, and maybe the cell phone kicked him over the edge. That's a rare individual, as I see it. I know this is a controversial subject. There are lots of people who think that cell phones are dangerous. There are 7.3 billion cell phones in use on planet Earth right now. There are more people with an operating cell phone than there are people with access to a working toilet. To some degree, cell phones are more important than toilets, as far as the way people are behaving. There are some countries that have more cell phones than population. The United States is one of them. I think the cell phone population right now in the United States is 103%. There's quite a number of people with double cell phones. So you measure every man, woman, and child population in the United States, there are more cell phones than there are people. Boy, is that an idea that's going to catch on. That RF radiating device, I think it's an idea that's going to catch on. We love portable communication. K2RIW listening.
Direction, with response to Dr. Wright.
All right, go ahead, Deb.
Repeater, time out.
I'll wait for the beeps and go ahead, Wes.
There was a question about antiparticles, mainly antiphoton. Dr. Wright.
Yes, Wesley?
Well, let me contradict. Let me try. Quantum field theory requires for consistency reasons that every charged particle has its own antiparticle. So it tells you what properties will the antiparticle have. It will have the same characteristic from the point of view of space-time. So let's take Pontier group. That would mean equal mass and spin, and it will have all charges and opposite signs that the metaparticle. So the short answer is there are antiphotons, and it is yes. But the disappointment here is that antiphotons are the photons, actually the same particles. Enter again.
Well, as I mentioned before, there are particles whose antiparticle is the same particle, and that's just one of those things. But you yourself said all charged particles must have antiparticles. Photons aren't charged. They're chargeless.
If the particle is not charged, then QFT doesn't impose any other constraint, and so you don't need antiparticles for photons, since they are not charged. But you can still consider the same operation of keeping mass and spin and swapping charges, since this does nothing to a photon. You can decide to identify it with antiphoton. Your call.
I guess you could call it a zebra too, but it doesn't really have any relevance to anything. There's no mutual annihilation. There's nothing that isn't a characteristic of an antiparticle. There's nothing that's reversed because it has a value of zero charge. So the opposite of zero is still zero, and I don't know. It becomes a case of discussing the English language more than physics. But for all intents and purposes, there is no practical concept of an antiphoton. You Google it, and you're not going to find much.
Yeah, let me try something on this one. Roy.
But let me first respond to Dr. Roy.
Now, Roy said something very interesting. If there was an antiproton, and you combined it with a proton, they would not annihilate each other. That suggests there really is no antiproton by the conventional definition of anti. Is that sort of true, Roy?
Then it's a particle.
I think you mean antiphoton, not antiproton. There are antiprotons out there, and they do annihilate protons. But we're talking about antiphoton.
Yes, I meant to say antiphoton. If I had a photon and what I think is an antiphoton, and I combine them, they do not annihilate. That would suggest that the antiphoton really is an anti. Would it suggest that, Roy?
Photons do annihilate themselves. There is a reaction like Y plus Y should translate to E plus, plus E minus for the electron, and it exists. So now it is true that you won't find a single vertex with two photons because a process involving a photon must be related to flux of electric charges. With two neutral photons, such flux is, of course, impossible.
You can't violate conservation of mass energy. So if you make two photons go away, you have to put something in their place or the police get you.
Yeah, let me try something on this one. If I move my handy-talkie around in the room and I'm listening to a weak signal, I've got multipath going on, I can find places where I get a null, where the handy-talkie says there's no signal there. And if I analyze that signal in that location, I might find out that there was one signal coming from the north into my rubber duck antenna, another signal reflecting off some object in the room, like a file cabinet, and coming from the south and getting into my rubber duck antenna. And those two signals were out of phase, and I got a cancellation at that point. So my rubber duck saw nothing. Did that signal from the north and the signal from the south really cancel each other at that point in space? They appeared to. But that signal flowing from the north kept right on flowing from north to south. The signal from the south kept right on flowing from south to north. I sense what I think is a null in my rubber duck of that handy-talkie. Did I really cancel those two signals? Absolutely not. They flowed through that part of space where my rubber duck was located, and they kept right on flowing. The signals did not cancel. So an electromagnetic wave, can you put two electromagnetic waves together and cancel them? I think the answer is no. That photon, in some cases, is an electromagnetic wave. So if I've got a photon and what I think is an antiphoton, and I combine them, first of all, I don't think they really cancel. But even if I sense at that one point in space what I think is a cancellation, I think they keep right on flowing, and they don't interact with each other. I wonder if you agree with some of that, Roy. AC2GS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, AC2GS, one of the curious things about photons or electromagnetic waves is that they do not interact with each other directly. They can interact by way of an intermediary mass-containing particle, which would be your antenna. But without a object to interact with, the electromagnetic waves would just pass right through each other and fail to interact. Now, we've discussed this a few times, but it always is good to repeat things like this.
And it's also a subset of energy cannot be created or destroyed. So those two waves, one from the north and one from the south, do not destroy each other. Energy of those waves keeps right on going. So they appear to cancel at my rubber duck, but they don't really cancel because energy cannot be created or destroyed. Is that sort of true, Roy? AC2GS, K2IW?
It depends on how you really look at it. I mean, ultimately what's really happening is the electromagnetic waves are interacting with your conductor on your antenna. And they're being destroyed, and an electric current is being induced in your antenna that's going to run down your circuitry, get amplified, demodulated, and you'll listen to the signal. So once it interacts with the metal and the photon gets absorbed, it's just like if you flash a flashlight at a black piece of fabric, those photons are gone because they get absorbed. So in that way, they're destroyed, but they turn into something else. They turn into electrical current because you must conserve mass energy. You cannot destroy it. You can just change it to something else, but you can't do away with it.
Because you agree with it. You're dealing with the energy deposited by photon on the mass, which would be electrical conductor. And the cancellation takes place in terms of electrical signals, not photons, and direction.
Yeah, that beam of light aimed at the black piece of paper, the energy is not lost. It turned into heat. The piece of paper runs hotter as it absorbs that light.
say you just convert it from one form to another. So the mass-energy relationship stays the same. Energy cannot be created or destroyed, just changed from one form to another. It's changed from a photon of energy to heat energy on that black piece of paper. Is that one way of looking at it, Roy? AC2GS, K2LIW?
Exactly. You're changing it into a portion of it goes into increase of average kinetic energy of the object, and eventually that average kinetic energy is going to be irradiated the way black body radiation as infrared.
Let me put this object back to what I was saying. You know, I say that there are antiprotons. However, the disappointment is that the antiprotons, photons are photons, and they are the same particles. So particles are their own arbitrary particles. The Z boson or the gluons, which mediate the electromagnetic force, the weak nuclear force and the strong force, respectively, the particles that are their own antiparticles must be electrically neutral, because antiparticles have the opposite electrical charge, and partner particles, of course, the opposite to the first one. So, other things must be at zero, like the number of quarks. We could also speculate about the neutron. Let me drop it. Thank you very much. We could also speculate about the neutron. The neutron cannot be its own antiparticle because it's made up of quarks, and antineutron is made out of antiquarks. Dr. Roy.
I think we can conclude this particular discussion by saying that Roy and many people believe there is no such thing as a proton and an antiproton. I can tell that Wes believes that there are antiphotons.
No, I don't believe. I just have a philosophical discussion with Dr. Wolf. I don't believe there is an antiphoton. It is theoretically antiphoton. Yes, it is.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Trying to put a carrier on me. Doesn't matter. Dr. Roy, did you get it?
Yeah, I got it, Wesley. And, you know, we could talk about quarks and anti-quarks and all manner of things some other week. Well, you know, we've chatted about physics a lot tonight, and I'd just like to give it back to Dick. I don't know if he wants to do anything more with the mailbag or what, but it's Dick's show, so back to Dick.
Okay, thank you, Roy. We've had our first mailbag submission. Hopefully there will be more of them as time goes on. Write your mailbag submission to Roy by going to technet@alpha-charlie-2-golf-sierra.com. So it's technet@ac2gs.com. And if you're one of those guys who likes listening to the TechNet, hopefully, and don't yet have your ham radio license, don't have the right equipment to talk to us, by way of the mailbag, you can get your question onto the TechNet, and hopefully we'll discuss it and in most cases get some answers to it. Right now I'm going to go over to the space report. Paul's going to give us space report number 272 of the series. And what's NASA and the European Space Agency and the Japan Space Agency and all these other guys, what are they doing this week, Paul? What are they about to launch? And hopefully the James Webb Space Telescope is still on schedule to be launched in the spring of 2018, and arguably that's going to be the biggest telescope ever put into space, the most sensitive thing, and it's going to be detecting all kinds of things that we've never seen before. When they put up Hubble, they never expected to see all the things it did see. They never expected to find a 2 trillion galaxies in the observable universe. Never expected that before they put up Hubble. And the James Webb is many times bigger than Hubble. Just wait and see. WS2F, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
This is WS2N, James Webb. Yes, that's going to still go the springtime of 2018. They just recently changed that. It used to be September or October of next, you know, of the, wait, let me, you said 2018, Dick? No, it's spring of 2019. It was supposed to go 2018, September, October, and now it's been delayed to the spring of 2019, Dick.
I stand corrected, thank you.
Yeah, that just happened, so that's not fresh in my mind either. I was all getting ready to watch this thing next year. I want to see it take off live, and we will be able to see it take off live from French Guiana. It will be launched by the European Space Agency on an Ariane 5 rocket, so that should be pretty exciting. And the success rate with those things is phenomenal. So I expect it to get off the ground okay. So many things happening during the week, so we always have something coming up here for the SpaceNet. Last Wednesday, astronaut Randy Bresnak and his partner Mark Vanderheil, they went outside the International Space Station on an EVA for the spacewalk, Expedition 53 crew, and they went out to continue working on the end effector, this latching end effector that's at the end of the robotic arm. This whole setup is about 4,000 pounds on the end of this 57-foot robotic arm. They replaced that whole unit last week, and you know, previous week, and now on Wednesday they went out and worked on it. They had to lubricate it and do some other get-ahead work for it as well. And there's going to be one more spacewalk next week on the 18th. Going to do some more work outside too. And each spacewalk is about 6 or 7 hours. You know, they've been doing pretty good, so we'll look forward to watching them do that on the 18th. As far as next launches go, we were supposed to have a next launch of Progress.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Progress ship was supposed to go up last week, but it shut down right before launch at its launch pad in Kazakhstan. Russians were going to send this about 5,000 pounds worth of stuff up to the International Space Station. So it was scrubbed. They worked on the problem and managed to get it off a couple of days later. It would have been the first time they could launch a spacecraft directly to the International Space Station. It would have gotten there in 3 hours. Their record is 8 hours. It's usually when they do about four orbit flight. It takes about 6.5 hours to dock with the space station. And now they could do it in 3 hours. A little over two orbits. And that was the next plan, but it had to take off at the exact right time. In fact, they'll slow the space station down or speed it up to get to the right position. It has to be right overhead when the rocket takes off from that, whatever location you're on, to make that rendezvous within a 3 hour period. That would have been the first time they would have done it. If it was successful, they probably would have done it maybe one or two more times with future Progress ships, and eventually they would have done it with manned missions as well. So much for that. At least it got off the ground and they're able to get supplies into the space station. Now, last Monday, SpaceX launched another Iridium satellite early in the morning from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, and they launched 10 more Iridium satellites, each one of 2,000 pounds each. That joins 20 other satellites on the next Iridium program. They're going to have a total of roughly 66, and then some extra ones from backups by the time they're done. Now that was a successful launch. Everything went into orbit properly. They spaced their 10 satellites in the proper location. And at the same time, the first stage, 150-foot booster, came back down out of space and landed in the Pacific Ocean on another drone ship. They have a drone ship positioned in the Pacific, and they have one also in the Atlantic. And it was successful, landed dead center. I saw the picture of it, dead center of the bullseye on that ship. Each autonomous landing ship is about the size of a football field, and they have a bullseye right in the middle of it with the SpaceX symbol on it. So then a couple of days later, and they launched another rocket from Florida, Cape Canaveral Launch Complex 39A, and this was a flight for SDS. It was an Echo satellite, communication satellite, going to geosynchronous orbit. And like I said before, they had a ship in the Pacific Ocean. They had another one stationed in the Atlantic Ocean, about 400 miles downrange. Sure enough, that booster successfully landed on that autonomous ship. And this time, this was a reused booster. This is the third time they've done it, where they've taken a previous flown booster, put it onto a rocket, sent it up, and landed onto a boat. So he promised this many years ago, and sure enough, he's able to do it. And it's starting to bring down the cost of his flight. And he's running out of storage for all these things that are coming back. In total now, I think they're up to 17 flights where the booster has come back and landed properly. The earlier flights, they used to crash on the deck and land in water, but now he's got like 17 in a row, and some of these boosters will be reused. And that's not the only thing he's reusing. When he sends up a Dragon spacecraft from cargo to the International Space Station, he's starting to reuse those spacecraft as well. Back the heat shield parachute land in the Pacific Ocean, they refurbish it, and they have already sent the Dragon cargo vehicle back up to the space station. Let me drop it. This is WS2N.
Net time complete.
That time complete. I'm not sure what that was about, but okay. Was listening to Sci Friday. They call it Sci-Fi Friday. That's the show that's on NPR every Friday. It's about 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock on Fridays on radio. And they have usually Ira Flatow. He's on vacation. He was replaced, but they interviewed this one woman from The Verge, and she's talking about the new presidential council that they have. Vice president is in charge, involved with NASA, and they're coming up with a new plan on what they should do in the near time future. Now, presently, NASA has been planning on sending a space station to lunar orbit. They call it the Deep Space Gateway, the DSG. Well, now, it turns out, according to this report from this science reporter, it turns out that the vice president is talking about setting up a new plan on actually developing landers that they would like to land back on the moon, not just orbit it. The present plan was to just orbit the moon, build a space station, learn how to operate away from the Earth for long periods of time, and the habitat vehicles that they plan on building that will eventually be going out to Mars. And that was the present plan, but now it looks like they're changing that a little bit, and they want to continue that with that idea, but since we're in lunar orbit, let's develop a plan to send people down to the surface of the moon and build a lunar base. Now, this was the first president that was interesting. They haven't had any. They haven't shown what type of vehicles they're planning on to use, that they're going to use. They haven't talked about the money that's involved. So it's just talk at this point. But it should be interesting to see what happens. It seems like from administration to administration, back in the Bush era, they had a Constellation program. Let's land on the moon. Let me drop it. They went to the Obama administration. Let's cancel the Constellation program. The only thing they kept out of that was the Orion vehicle in the Space Launch System, is still under development, and let's go to Mars. And now all of a sudden let's worry about Mars a little bit later. Let's not cross it off the list, but let's go back to the moon and actually create a lunar base on the moon. This is what they're planning. Back over to you, Dick. Any comments or questions? I had one email that I should bring up, and this has to do with locating spacecraft in space, the exact locations. How do they do that, and how do they locate these exact objects? In particular, this MU-69, 2014 MU-69 Kuiper Belt object that New Horizons is on the way to. 2019, on July 1st, pretty much talked about the distance, how we know where exactly New Horizon is, but how do they exactly know the exact location of these objects that they're on their way to? Also make sure that there's nothing in the way when they get near there, such as Pluto, with all the five moons. So that was a question I got on email from AC2LR. Back to you, Dick, WS2N.
Okay, I'll answer that question second, Paul. I've got a question for you first, and that is, you mentioned the fact that at Vandenberg Air Force Base, they launched 10 Iridium satellites. Each satellite weighs 2,000 pounds. Okay, I guess I did the mathematics wrong. I thought that was 200. So that's 20,000 pounds of total load. I guess all 10 satellites were launched at once with one particular launch vehicle. And then after they got released, I guess they're all in the same orbital plane, but get spread out across that orbital plane. So did all 10 Iridium satellites get launched at the same time? That's 20,000 pounds of total payload, not counting all the interconnecting hardware to connect them together. That sounds like it's close to 30,000 pounds of total payload. Get that up to a, not a LEO, low Earth orbit, it's a medium Earth orbit. I think are medium Earth orbit satellites at around 10,000 foot of altitude. Is that true, Paul? That sounds like an awful good trick. Not much payload. WS2N, K2LIW.
That would be the GPS ones, usually around 11,000 miles, half the distance to geosynchronous. But these are probably, I think they're around 400, 500 miles high. The third group of satellites that have been launched by SpaceX over the last year, they've all been launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base. Time they launch, they go into a different plane of different inclination than the previous launch. Yes, there's 10 satellites on each launch, and each one's 2,000 pounds. And they have this system where you can see they have a camera on board the spacecraft. So after a couple of minutes, the first stage separates. See that to a 180, it has nitrogen jets, does a 180, then it does burn three of the Merlin D engines fire, and it starts pushing itself back to a situation where they're going to eventually land on that ship down below. But the second stage keeps going and has camera on board, and you can see the satellites launch one right after the other until they're all gone. And they plan on doing this, three more times, and then probably a fourth time for
for some spares.